A sloth, a donkey, and a curious human. Send a prompt and see what they're doing. One hits a record with a question on his mind. Two brothers pick it up, see what they find. Corn takes his time, Herman's got the facts. Back and forth, they never hold back. My weird prompts, come on in, that's where we begin. My weird prompts, glad you're here.
This episode was generated using artificial intelligence. Please verify facts.
You're sitting in a 200-ton aluminum tube, descending through fog so thick you can't see the wingtip outside your window. The pilots up front can't see the runway. They can't see the approach lights. They can't see anything. And yet, without a single visual reference, the aircraft flares, settles, and touches down exactly on the center line, wheels kissing pavement before human eyes ever confirm the ground was there.
It's one of those things that sounds like science fiction until you realize it happens hundreds of times a day, all over the world, and nobody on board even looks up from their drink.
That's the part that gets me. The sheer ordinariness of it. Flight 187 touches down in pea soup at Heathrow. The seatbelt sign dings off, and someone's already complaining about the queue at passport control. Nobody realizes they just experienced one of the most tightly engineered sequences in all of transportation.
Daniel's prompt gets right to the heart of why. He's asking what it actually takes to pull off a true near-zero visibility landing. Not the marketing version, not the plane lands itself, headline, but the real chain of systems, certifications, and procedures that all have to be perfect simultaneously.
Here's the central question. How does a machine navigate the last 50 feet of flight when the human brain is effectively blind? And the answer, and this is what I think most people miss, is that it's not one system. It's not a magic button. It's a stack, ground equipment that has to be stable to tolerances, that sound made up, aircraft hardware that has to be triple redundant and cross-checking itself 80 times a second, crew training that has to keep pilots ready to take over in under 2 seconds if any of it fails, and airport infrastructure that extends all the way from the runway surface to the taxiway markings.
If any single piece of that chain breaks, one sensor drifts, one autopilot disagrees, one RVR reading drops below minimums, the whole approach is off. You don't land.
Before we get into the hardware, let's make sure we're all speaking the same language about what these categories actually mean. Because zero visibility landing gets thrown around a lot, but the difference between a foggy day and a true Category 3 approach is bigger than most people realize.
Every instrument landing system approach is categorized by two numbers, decision height and runway visual range. Decision height is the altitude where the pilot has to see the runway environment. If they don't see it by that point, they go around. RVR is how far you can see down the runway, measured in meters or feet.
Most passengers have experienced a Category 1 approach. Decision height of 200 feet, RVR of about 550 meters. If you've ever been on a flight that popped out of the clouds a few hundred feet above the runway, that was a Cat 1. Every airline pilot does these.
Category 2 gets tighter. Decision height drops to 100 feet, RVR down to 300 meters. Still visual, still something a trained crew handles regularly.
Then there's Category 3, which is where things get genuinely strange. Cat 3A, decision height of 100 feet or less, RVR no lower than 175 meters. Cat 3B, decision height of 50 feet or less, RVR down to 150 meters. The pilot might see the runway lights at 50 feet, might not, and still lands.
Then there's Cat 3C, no decision height, no RVR minimum. Theoretically, you could land in absolute zero visibility. The world outside is a gray void, and the system will still put the aircraft on the runway. In practice, Cat 3C is almost never used operationally, because even if you can land, you still have to taxi to the gate. But the capability exists.
When Daniel says essentially zero visibility, he's describing Cat 3B, maybe Cat 3C territory. And here's the thing about autoland in those conditions. It's not a switch you flip. The aircraft has to be in a specific configuration, with all three autopilots engaged on an Airbus, or two autopilots in dual-channel mode on a Boeing. The system has to pass continuous self-tests throughout the entire approach. And if it fails below 100 feet, there is no leisurely decision about what to do next.
That's the part that separates Cat 3 from everything else. In a Cat 1 approach, if something goes wrong at 200 feet, you go around. You've got time, altitude, visual references. In Cat 3B, if the autoland fails at 30 feet, three stories off the ground, the crew has to recognize the failure and execute a missed approach immediately, or they're committed to landing blind on a system they know has just malfunctioned.
30 feet at approach speed is about 1.5 seconds.
1.5 seconds to detect, decide, and act, while staring into fog.
The stakes are about as high as they get in commercial aviation, and that's what makes the engineering behind this so remarkable. Not just that it works, but that it works reliably enough that regulators signed off on it. Which brings us to the ground. What does it take to build an ILS that can guide a plane to the runway when nobody can see it?
The ILS is two radio beams. The localizer gives you lateral guidance left and right of the center line. The glide slope gives you vertical guidance, typically a 3-degree descent path. For a Category 1 approach, those beams need to be reasonably stable. For Category 3, reasonably stable isn't even in the vocabulary.
What's the actual number?
The localizer beam for Cat 3 has to be stable to within 0.001 degrees. If it drifts more than that, the integrity monitoring system has to detect it and shut down the approach within 2 seconds.
So the system isn't just precise, it's precise and paranoid. It's watching itself constantly, and if it sees even a whisper of drift, it pulls the plug before the aircraft ever commits.
The glide slope has the same kind of redundant integrity checking. Both beams are monitored by separate receivers at the far end of the runway. If the near-field monitor and the far-field monitor disagree, even slightly, the whole ILS is flagged as unreliable. The system is designed to fail safe, and it fails safe fast.
Which is why only about 60 to 70 airports worldwide actually have Cat 3 certified ILS installations. It's not that the hardware is impossible to build, it's that the certification and maintenance burden is enormous. You're committing to continuous monitoring, regular flight checks, and the kind of ground infrastructure that most airports can't justify.
London Heathrow is the busiest Cat 3 airport in the world. On a foggy winter morning, they'll handle dozens of autoland approaches in a single hour. But Heathrow can justify that because they get the kind of persistent fog that would otherwise shut the airport down for days. For most airports, the cost-benefit doesn't pencil out.
It's not just the ILS transmitters. The runway itself has to meet Cat 3 standards. You need high-intensity approach lighting, centerline lighting embedded in the runway, touchdown zone lighting, and RVR measurement sensors at three separate points, the touchdown zone, the midpoint, and the rollout end.
Those RVR sensors are transmisometers. They shoot a beam of light across a known distance and measure how much gets through. You need three of them because visibility can vary dramatically along a runway. You might have 150 meters at the touchdown zone, but only 100 meters at the rollout. If any one of those three sensors reports below minimums, the approach is not authorized.
We've got beam stable to 1/1000 of a degree, triple redundant visibility sensors, runway lighting that looks like a Christmas tree on full blast, and we haven't even gotten to the aircraft yet.
And the aircraft side is where the redundancy philosophy really peaks. For Cat 3 Autoland, the system has to demonstrate a failure probability of less than 10⁻⁹ per approach. That's one catastrophic failure in a billion landings.
That's the kind of number that makes you stop and think about what acceptable risk actually means in aviation.
To hit that number, you need triple redundant everything. On an Airbus, all three autopilot computers are engaged during the approach. They're cross-checking each other constantly. On the A380, that cross-check happens 80 times per second. If one computer disagrees with the other two, it's voted out instantly, and the approach continues on the remaining two. If a second one disagrees, the approach is over and the crew goes around.
Boeing does it slightly differently. Two autopilots in dual channel mode, with each channel doing its own internal monitoring. Different architecture, same philosophy. No single point of failure can bring the system down without the crew knowing about it immediately.
The radio altimeters are dual redundant too. Those are what the autoland system uses to figure out where the ground actually is. Unlike a human pilot who flares by sight, the autoland system computes a flare initiation point purely from radio altitude. Typically, it starts the flare at 40 to 50 feet, then smoothly reduces the vertical speed from around 700 feet per minute to about 120 feet per minute at touchdown.
which is smoother than most human landings, honestly.
And it's also doing something subtle that passengers never notice. The system crabs into the wind on final approach to maintain the center line, then just before touchdown, it decrabs, aligns the nose with the runway, using differential braking and rudder input. A human pilot does this by feel. The autoland does it by algorithm, and it does it in the last second before the wheels touch.
You've got an aircraft that's cross-checking its own brain 80 times a second, measuring its height above the ground with redundant radar, and executing a flare and decrab maneuver that most pilots would describe as butter, all while the humans in the cockpit are staring at a wall of gray.
Those humans are not just passengers. That's the part we'll get into next. The human factors paradox in CAT 3 operations is one of the most interesting problems in aviation psychology. You've got two highly trained pilots sitting in a cockpit watching a system that is demonstrably more precise than they could ever be. The autoland can hold the center line to within a few feet in a crosswind that would have a human pilot sawing at the yoke. And yet those pilots have to remain ready to take control in under 2 seconds if any part of the system hiccups.
Which sounds like a recipe for the brain checking out entirely. If I'm watching something do a job better than I can, my instinct is to mentally pour a cup of tea and let it get on with it.
That's exactly the problem. It's called passive monitoring fatigue. The human brain is wired to disengage when it has no active task. Hand-flying an approach keeps you in the loop because every control input requires attention and feedback. But monitoring an autoland, watching parameters scroll past on a screen, waiting for something to deviate, that's cognitively harder than actually flying. You're fighting your own neurology.
How do you train for that? How do you keep someone razor sharp while asking them to do nothing?
Full motion simulator work, and lots of it. To maintain CAT 3 currency, every pilot has to complete a minimum of 6 autoland approaches in the sim every 6 months. And the training isn't just watch the plane land 6 times. The instructors inject failures at the worst possible moments. Autopilot disconnect at 50 feet. Loss of localizer signal inside the flare. Sudden wind shear right as the system initiates the decrab maneuver.
They have to recognize the failure and react within that 1.5 second window we talked about.
The sim instructors measure it. If you don't catch the failure and initiate the go-around within 2 seconds, you fail the currency check. And it's not theoretical. There was an incident at Heathrow with the British Airways. A 320 autopilot disconnect at 30 feet during a CAT 3 approach. The crew recognized it, executed the go-around, and were climbing out before most passengers even registered. Something was wrong. The incident report specifically credited their simulator training for the response time.
That's the height of a telephone pole.
At approach speed, they had maybe 1.2 seconds from disconnect to decision. That's not flying skill at that point. That's drilled reflex.
Which brings up something I hadn't considered until now. Even after a perfect autoland touchdown, wheels down, centerline, butter, the flight isn't over. You're now on the ground in visibility so low you can't see the taxiway turn off.
This is the rollout and taxi problem, and it's why CAT 3C is almost never used operationally. Landing is only half the battle. You still have to get a 200-ton aircraft from the runway to the gate without being able to see the signs, the markings, or the other aircraft.
How does that work?
It requires airport surface detection equipment, ground radar that tracks every vehicle and aircraft on the airfield. The controllers see a screen with every position plotted in real time and talk the crew through the taxi route turn by turn. On the flight deck side, most CAT-3 capable aircraft have head-up displays or electronic moving maps that show the aircraft's position on the airport diagram using GPS and inertial reference.
It's basically air traffic control playing a verbal version of warm, warmer, hot, while the pilots follow a dot on a screen.
At 3 miles an hour, in fog so thick you can't see the winglet, yes. And this only works at airports that have invested in the surface radar. Which, again, narrows the list. You need the CAT 3 ILS, the runway lighting, the RVR sensors, the surface movement radar, and the published low-visibility taxi routes. Missing any one of those and the whole operation falls apart.
The chain we've been tracing, ground equipment, aircraft systems, crew training, it doesn't end at the runway threshold. It extends all the way to the jet bridge.
That's the thing I think most people, even aviation enthusiasts, don't fully appreciate. When you see CAT 3B in a flight log, you're not looking at a single technology. you're looking at a multi-million dollar investment in ground infrastructure, years of aircraft certification testing, hundreds of hours of simulator time for every crew member on the flight deck, and airport equipment that most facilities will never install.
There's also a geographic limit that doesn't get talked about enough. Some airports physically cannot support Cat 3 no matter how much money they spend. San Francisco is the classic example. The terrain around the airport interferes with the glide slope signal in ways that make Cat 3 precision impossible. The hills are literally in the way.
That's not fixable. You can't move a mountain to get a cleaner glide slope beam. So SFO operates Cat 1 ILS, and when the fog rolls in, which it does, famously, the airport just has to reduce its arrival rate. No amount of technology overcomes geography.
Which is a humbling thought. For all the billions spent on aviation technology, a hill in the wrong place can still limit what's possible.
That geographic constraint ties into the operational limits even at airports that do have Cat 3. It's not just, is the ILS working? There's a whole matrix of conditions that have to line up. Cat 3 approaches have hard wind limits, and they're surprisingly tight. Maximum crosswind component is typically 15 to 20 knots, depending on the aircraft type and airline op spec. Headwind maxes out around 25 knots. Beyond that, the Autoland system can't guarantee it'll keep the aircraft within the touchdown zone.
Which makes sense when you think about what the system is doing during that last second decrab maneuver. If the crosswind is too strong, the differential braking and rudder authority might not be enough to align the nose before the wheels are down.
Then there are weight and balance constraints. Too far forward on the center of gravity and the flare profile changes. The nose might come down harder than the system expects. Too far aft and you risk a tail strike because the rotation geometry shifts.
It's not just the weather is bad. Let's use Autoland. You also need the right airplane loaded the right way, at the right airport, with the right wind conditions.
The right paperwork. The airport has to have a functioning Category 3 approach procedure published and current. If the procedure is NOTAMED out of service, say the RVR sensors are down for maintenance, or the approach lighting system has a fault, the approach simply doesn't exist that day. You can't improvise a Cat 3.
Which brings us back to the crew. We've talked about the simulator training and the 1.5 second reaction window. But there's another layer here that I think gets overlooked. The decision to even attempt the approach in the first place.
Before the crew ever starts down the glide slope, they have to verify that every single condition is met. The aircraft is certified and configured. The crew is current. The airport is reporting RVR at or above minimums on all three sensors. The wind is within limits. The NOTAMs are clear. If any one of those checks fails, they don't shoot the approach.
That's a go-no-go decision that happens at 250 knots, often while holding, sometimes with the dispatcher on the other end of the radio saying, "But the fuel situation."
Which is where the human factors get really sharp. The system is designed to be conservative, but the humans operating it are under real-world pressure. You've got a cabin full of passengers who want to get home. You've got an airline operations center watching your fuel burn. And you've got a captain who has to say, not today, if the numbers don't line up.
Are there conditions where Autoland is actually worse than a human pilot?
Yes, and this surprises people. Autoland is optimized for precision on the centerline and in the touchdown zone. But in gusty crosswind conditions that are still within limits, a human pilot can sometimes produce a smoother landing because they can anticipate and react to gusts in a way the algorithm can't. The Autoland is reacting to what the aircraft is doing right now. A skilled pilot is reacting to what the aircraft is about to do.
The machine is more precise, but the human has better intuition about the next half second.
In certain edge cases, yes. The Autoland will put you exactly on the center line every time, but it might do it with a firmer touchdown than a pilot who feels the gust building and eases the flare. The trade-off is that the human can't do it in zero visibility. In Cat 3 conditions, precision beats feel because feel doesn't work when you can't see.
That's the paradox in a nutshell. The system is better than you at the thing you need it to do, worse than you at the thing you can't do anyway, and you still have to be ready to take over in the time it takes to blink.
We've got the ground equipment, the aircraft systems, and the crew training all aligned. What should we actually take away from this?
I think the thing that really lands for me, and I didn't fully appreciate this until we started pulling it apart, is that Autoland is a terrible name for what's actually happening. It makes it sound like the plane is landing itself. like the humans are just along for the ride.
That's exactly the misconception that drives me up the wall. Autoland is not autonomy in any meaningful sense. It's a tightly coupled human-machine system where the machine handles precision and the humans handle failure detection and recovery. The machine is brilliant at holding a center line to within inches. It is completely useless at knowing when it's wrong.
Which means the system is only as reliable as the weakest link in the chain. You can have a perfect ILS beam, triple redundant flight computers, and a runway lit up like a stadium. And if the crew hasn't done their six sim approaches in the last 6 months, none of it matters.
Or if one RVR sensor is down for maintenance. Or if the NOTAMs weren't checked. Or if the wind just ticked up 2 knots past the limit. The chain is long and every link has to hold.
The cost of building that chain is staggering when you add it up. The ground infrastructure alone, the ILS installation certified to Cat 3, the approach lighting, the RVR sensors, the surface movement radar. We're talking tens of millions of dollars per runway.
Then add the aircraft side. Certifying a new airframe for Cat 3 Autoland takes years of testing. Every failure mode has to be demonstrated, every redundancy has to be proven, and that 1 in a billion failure probability has to be backed up by actual flight test data and statistical analysis. It's not a paper number.
Then the training. Hundreds of hours of simulator time per crew member, repeated every 6 months, for the entire career of every pilot who flies Cat 3 approaches. That's a continuous operating cost that never goes away.
When you see a Cat 3B approach in a flight log, you're not looking at a button the pilot pressed. You're looking at the visible tip of an iceberg that goes down through decades of certification work, millions of dollars of ground equipment, and thousands of hours of human training.
Which brings up something Daniel's prompt made me think about. The future. We've got NextGen and GBAS, the ground-based augmentation system, starting to enable Cat 3-like precision without traditional ILS hardware. GPS corrections instead of radio beams.
GBAS is promising. You can theoretically get Cat 3 precision from a satellite-based system, which means you're not limited by terrain the way SFO is with its glide slope problems. But here's the thing, the certification bar doesn't move just because the technology changes.
Meaning that, 1 in a billion failure probability.
The crew training requirements? The human factors problem of passive monitoring fatigue? Still exactly the same brain dealing with exactly the same cognitive load. The technology changes, the human factors don't.
We can swap out the radio beams for satellite corrections, but we can't swap out the pilots staring into fog waiting for something to go wrong. That part is permanent. Which brings us to the question that keeps engineers up at night. As aircraft get more autonomous, Airbus has its Dragonfly project, Boeing's been running the Eco Demonstrator. Will we ever reach a point where Cat 3 operations don't require a human pilot in the loop at all?
I think about this a lot. The technical capability is getting closer. But that certification bar, 1 failure in a billion approaches, that's not a technical requirement, it's a societal one. We accept that level of risk from a human-machine team because the human is there as the backstop. Remove the human and suddenly you're asking passengers to trust pure autonomy with the same 1 in a billion promise.
Pure autonomy doesn't do. I have a bad feeling about this one. It doesn't notice that the turbulence feels weird, or that the wind shifted in a way the numbers aren't quite capturing yet.
That's the gap. A human pilot brings pattern recognition that isn't fully specifiable. The system can detect a localizer deviation in milliseconds, but it can't detect that the fog looks thicker than the RVR sensors are reporting because the sensors are spaced 3,000 feet apart and the pilot's looking out the window.
The question isn't really whether the machine can land the plane. It's whether we're willing to fly without the one component that knows when the machine might be wrong.
I don't think that changes anytime soon. Not because the technology can't get there, but because the regulatory philosophy that built the 1 in a billion standard isn't going anywhere. Aviation safety is built on layers. Autonomy removes a layer. Somebody has to prove that what replaces it is better, not just equivalent.
The next time you're on a flight that descends into fog, and the landing feels impossibly smooth, that gentle chirp of rubber on pavement you barely felt, remember what you just experienced. You didn't just experience a computer landing a plane. You experienced one of the most carefully engineered, redundantly certified, and rigorously trained operations in all of transportation, ground crews maintaining beams to a thousandth of a degree. Simulator instructors throwing failures at pilots who have 1.5 seconds to react. Flight computers cross-checking each other 80 times a second. And two humans in the cockpit, staring into gray nothing, ready to act before you ever knew anything was wrong.
Now, Hilbert's daily fun fact.
In the early 1900s, some Ottoman administrators believed that Kyrgyzstan's Lake Issyk-Kul never froze because it was heated by an underground connection to the Earth's molten core, a theory that survived in bureaucratic memos for nearly 2 decades before anyone thought to check the salinity.
Not a magma vent. My Weird Prompts is produced by Hilbert Flemingtop. If you enjoyed this episode, do us a favor and leave a review wherever you listen. It helps more people find the show. We'll be back with another one soon.
This episode's script was written by DeepSeek V4 Pro, with text-to-speech by Chatterbox.
Thanks for listening to our show, My Weird Prompts, where odd thoughts go. From sloth slow takes to facts on cue, we chase the strange and follow through. Some nights it's news, some nights it's lore, a thought you've never heard before. The hosts dig in, the hosts dig deep. The stranger the prompt, the less they sleep. From tiny questions, big ones too, from half-formed hunches to deja vu. If something odd is in your head, send it in, we'll chase the thread. My Weird Prompts, that's the close. From sloth, from man, from long-eared host. My Weird Prompts, until next time, stay curious, keep weird in mind.